You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we explain why it was a bad year for scabs and a good year for separatists on Press Progress sources. Review the weapon-selling Swedish royal family's December visit to Canada on Habitsi, please. Look back at the year in tech on Tech Won't Save Us and celebrate a landmark 1,000th episode of Green Majority. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And since launching in October 2022, Sources has provided in-depth interviews with experts and newsmakers across the country from the award-winning journalists at Press Progress. On this excerpt from a new episode, Ontario reporter Eric Wickham speaks to Labour correspondent Emma Arkell in Vancouver and Stephen Maguziak in Calgary about some of the favorite stories they worked on in 2025. Now, here's Eric.
You're listening to Sources. I'm your host, Ontario reporter Eric Wickham. 2025 was not a slow news year. Two elections, looming tariff threats, labor action, Alberta separation, and ostriches, for some reason, were just some of the many, many topics our team tackled this year. Beyond our editorial output, this was by far the biggest year of personnel changes in the newsroom as well. The team started this year with Romy, Luke, Stephen, and Ramneek, and ended it with four new additions to the team: Rishti, Emma, Jonathan, and me. We rarely get time to stop and reflect on the work we've done together, but for this special year-end episode of Sources, we decided to ask the newsroom to talk about some of the published work they were particularly proud of this year. It is the year-end, so not everyone was available to talk, but thank you to the reporters and editors who did. Let's start with our labor reporter, Emma Arkell. Emma, thanks for joining me on Sources.
Thank you for having me.
It's been 1 year as a Press Progress labor reporter.
Almost, yeah. I started in the spring.
A whole bunch of additions to the Press Progress newsroom, but we all sort of hit the ground running. And you have been doing labor coverage all over the country. You've hit so many big stories. First of all, how are you feeling?
I feel great. A little tired. You know, it's December. It's hibernation season. So excited for a break. But yeah, it's been a very eventful year of labor coverage, I think. And I started this job at the beginning of the federal election. So I also, really hit the ground running, as you say.
You have the Air Canada strike in there. You've covered all the developments with Canada Post workers. And we're going to talk about a story that you wrote about a DHL labor action in the summer.
Yeah, well, I was writing one of my Canada Post stories right after that report came out that recommended a bunch of changes to Canada Post. I started looking at other logistics companies and delivery companies, whether or not they were unionized and what their contracts look like. And I noticed that DHL has workers that are represented by Unifor, and they had been in bargaining for a while, I think probably about 8 or 9 months at that point, and it wasn't going well. Unifor put out a press release, you know, making that known. And so I kind of like put that on the back burner. And then in June, right before federal anti-scab legislation was introduced, DHL locked out its workers and called in some scabs.
I think that's a very interesting point to bring up, because they asked for an exemption from this rule or this new law that Canada was passing. And in that letter, I have it written down here, sorry. We have witnessed similar interventions during the ongoing strike at Canada Post, and we believe such action is warranted in our case, given that we provide essential logistics services to Canadians. I'm assuming this did not go over well on the picket line.
No, it really didn't. There were some like pretty contentious altercations somewhere in Ontario at one of the DHL centers. Workers were understandably very angry that busloads of scabs were being brought in. And when I went down to the picket line here in Vancouver, I found out that scabs were also being used out here as well.
You went down to the picket line, as you said. What can you tell us about that experience, and how did workers react to seeing a journalist there?
It was an interesting picket line. It was out near Vancouver Airport, which honestly, I've gone to that part of Richmond quite often for picket line coverage. I covered a number of hotel strikes that were happening out there. Obviously, then a couple months later, I went down for the Air Canada flight attendants picket line. But when I went down to cover the DHL labor dispute, I got to the airport, I took the SkyTrain, and I had to like walk out of the airport. And I realized I'd never really walked away from an airport before. I just always take a cab or the SkyTrain. So an interesting and like pretty dangerous pedestrian experience walking out of the airport. And I like couldn't find the picket line for a while. I knew where I was going. It took a while, but it's in, you know, a very industrial part of Richmond out near the airport. And the workers there were quite surprised to have a journalist come down and speak to them. I don't know if anyone else had been down for coverage, possibly like a TV crew or two. But yeah, it was, I think, the first time that they had had a journalist come down, do interviews and do more comprehensive coverage.
What made the story unique in my mind, at least, is DHL's use of non-union labor or scabs while their unionized workers were locked out, despite the fact that in a couple weeks, a law would be enacted to prevent non-union labor to be used during a labor action like this, which is like
notable.
I think can be seen by some people as intentionally inflammatory. I think in the story, someone refers to it as a slap in the face. I think this is going to be a bit of a trite question for a labor reporter, but I think it's worth asking for people that don't know. Why is using scab labor so inflammatory in a regular labor action? And was there something particular about this time that stuck out to you?
Yeah, scabs are hated within the labor movement for a number of reasons. The biggest one being that they undermine the power of the strike. You know, our biggest card as workers, the most impactful thing that we can do is withhold our labor. And when you have other workers brought in who agree to do your job while you're on strike, it undermines the power of the strike. It means that the boss can continue business during the strike, which they're not supposed to be able to do. A lot of the time when picket lines become contentious or violent, it's because the boss is bringing in workers to do the job of striking workers. And so there are great reasons why this law was passed. A lot of, you know, I think businesses were given a year's notice that this law would be coming into effect in June. You know, it's not as though DHL didn't know that this was going to happen. They totally did. And yet they still brought in workers right up until the deadline.
So eventually this labor action came to a conclusion. DHL workers accepted an agreement from DHL. What were some takeaways that you had from covering the story?
I think the DHL story reinforced why I think it's so valuable to have journalists go down to picket lines and speak to workers. I think they really appreciated having someone go down there and, you know, bring some awareness to the injustice that they were dealing with. And also that this new law, this ban of scab labor. And I should say that it is only for federally regulated workers. So this does not cover all workers in Canada by any means. Some provinces have anti-scab laws. I'm pretty sure BC is one of them. But a lot of provinces like Ontario, they do not have anti-scab legislation for provincially regulated workers. So this is only for federally regulated. But it is very impactful and it's very important. And I'm glad we got it before this new government, because I'm not sure this new government would pass that kind of legislation.
Government intervention in labor actions seems to be a recurring theme in some of the work that you did this year. Where do you think we're headed in 2026, and what should people be prepared for?
Yeah, government intervention in collective bargaining has been a huge issue this year, with everything that's happened at Canada Post, the release of that report, being forced to vote on a deal that it was pretty obvious Canada Post workers did not want, and then the barrage of changes that the government announced, not to mention what happened with Air Canada flight attendants. I don't think anyone really knows what's going to happen with Section 107, whether this government is going to try to use it again, despite the fact that the flight attendants showed that you don't have to follow the government when they do that. You can, if you're, I guess, in the position that the flight attendants were, you can resist that. I know the NDP has also attempted to table a bill that would repeal that part of the Canada Labor Code. So it'll be interesting to see what the future of that is. And then we also have provincial governments that are intervening in collective bargaining, with the UCP sending teachers back to work and forcing a contract on them that they resoundingly voted down. And then the Quebec government recently passing a law that allows them to end strikes if it's in the public interest. So I think that will continue to be an issue in this country.
If someone was interested in following this labor reporting, is there perhaps a newsletter that they could sign up for that would keep them up to date?
I think I know of one. I produce the Shift Work newsletter, where I track all of these strikes and lockouts across the country. And I also collect all of the big labor headlines. I also feature my own writing and reporting in Shift Work. And this week I will be featuring a story that just dropped yesterday about Simon Fraser University's attempt to make the new medical school they're building entirely non-union. They say the new medical school is very different than the other faculties at the school. And so it is so different and so new that the faculty there cannot be in the existing collective agreement. Very interesting situation. So I would love it if people would check that out.
Well, Emma, I guess this might be one of the last times we talk in 2025. So in case we don't have another pitch meeting between now and January, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Happy holidays.
That was labor reporter Emma Arkell. Follow her on Blue Sky at Emma Arkell. We're headed to Alberta next to speak with Press Progress Alberta reporter Stephen Maguziak about a fairly controversial topic, Alberta separation. Stephen Maguziak, Alberta reporter for Press Progress. Welcome to Sources.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
It's very weird saying it to you, considering that you are the host for most of the episodes of the show.
Yeah. Unfortunately, my latest setup in my new place is not ideal for podcasting. I'm working on that, but there's a lot of ambient noise in the new place that has just made it a little bit tough. So if my audio quality is coming through a little bit choppy, I apologize, folks.
I'm happy that you said that to the audience. I'm sure they'll forgive you. I think they'll be happy to hear from you. We're looking forward to you getting a good setup and you back to hosting. I thought this has been a good year for the podcast.
Absolutely, it has. With the introduction of a new editor at Press Progress, Jonathan Goldsby, who has some experience in this field. I feel like things have been going great for Sources.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun to do as well. And I think people are responding to it because we're seeing our downloads go up. I'm not here to talk about the metrics for the podcast, though. I'm here to talk about a story that stuck out to you in 2025 that you worked on, something you enjoyed or something you think will have a lot of carryover into 2026. And so I'm just going to set the stage super quick because I do feel like this feels like it was a lifetime ago. This year started with a ton of talk from the United States about Canada becoming the 51st state. Obviously, most of the country reacted exactly the way you think they would, angrily, but there was a faction of people in Alberta that didn't feel quite the same, and you covered them back in July. So I guess just starting this whole thing off, why would people in Alberta want to separate from Canada?
That's been a question that's been going on for decades, but it surges whenever the Liberals are in power. They have this notion that we'd be one of the richest countries on earth if we could just rid ourselves of Ottawa. So broadly, this movement is anti-immigration. They definitely want less of that. They have an almost religious devotion to pipelines and this absolute seething hatred for what they see as Eastern elites that control our lives, in Ottawa especially.
Well, I find that so fascinating just because, I mean, you said that there's this notion that Alberta would be one of the richest countries on earth, which is objectively not true.
That's correct. Yeah, I don't see how a landlocked province is going to get anywhere, but they compare us to jurisdictions like Norway with its sovereign wealth fund. Another one of the reasons they want to separate from Canada is a lot of this is coming from far-right evangelical Christian circles as well, a form of that kind of Christianity that just absolutely despises any kind of government whatsoever, like controlling what they do, taxes, anything, you name it. It's a really, really severe form of individualism, and they see any kind of interference from Ottawa as running against that. And they are a powerful part of southern Alberta, especially, but across the province, particularly in rural areas.
Right. I guess this leads me into asking a question about this organization that put together these town halls that you were covering. So what is the Alberta Prosperity Project, and who are the people behind it?
So without going too much into detail, the Alberta Prosperity Project is a separatist group that has been around for quite a long time, but kind of surged during the convoy movement. And they are just outright Alberta separatists. They are very anti-vax, of course, and they are led by, I'd say, three key individuals. One of them is Dr. Dennis Modry. I don't believe he's a doctor anymore, but he was. Their lawyer is Jeffrey Rath, a rancher. He's a big guy. He looks a little bit like how I imagine Judge Holden from Blood Meridian to look like big guy, big toothy grin, wears a cowboy hat. He has been actually one of Smith's most vocal opponents within that movement. Rath went to their AGM in 2025, back in November, and took the mic. And he went up to the mic not to ask a question, but to just gauge the audience for support for Alberta independence at the AGM. And it became this really disruptive scene with boos and everything like that. Smith actually had to subdue the crowd. So Rath is a bit of a rabble-rouser. And then there's Mitch Sylvester, the current president of the Alberta Prosperity Project. He was a former Take Back Alberta organizer. And between the three of them, they took their show on the road, traveling literally all across the province, holding town halls, traveling absolutely everywhere. Like, the organizing power that went into what they did is frankly really impressive.
I'm glad you brought up the fact that separatists are not a monolith. They disagree in the specific method in which to achieve separation. So what can you tell me about these town halls? What transpired at them, and what was a typical itinerary for one of these town halls?
So what they'll typically do is they'll take a show of hands saying, how many of you are in favor of an independent Alberta? And then most of the hands will typically go up. And then the three of them, or maybe two of them, depends if they can get all three, but they'll take turns at the mic and they'll sort of inoculate the audience against a constitutional path towards separation. They don't like the Constitution. They see it as a roadblock. That's not the way to do it. So they kind of just tell the audience that this is a non-starter. Don't bother. It's not going to be done with voting. We need to take a more radical approach to it.
That was an excerpt from a recent episode of Press Progress Sources. Find out more at pressprogress.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Broadcasting since September 2020, Habib T. Please features activist and academic Nashwalina Khan exploring politics, pop culture, and beyond from an internationalist and Canadian perspective. On this excerpt from a new episode, she sits down with Community University Television's Local 514 for a conversation unpacking the Swedish royal family's December trip to Montreal and Ottawa, a weapons-peddling state visit largely framed by mainstream media as ceremonial, benign, and cultural. Now, here's the show.
Hey, Habibtis. Welcome back to Habibti, Please. This episode starts with something that flew under the radar for many Canadians, a royal visit. Swedish king and queen were in Montreal and Ottawa, and what ensued was puff pieces, photo ops, handshakes, and headlines that treated it as ceremonial, charming, and even cute.
Yes, they made him. Kush, they made him.
Wasn't a neutral visit. Well, myself and my friend Colin Detsenpa, a journalist from Montreal's Community University Television, also known as CUTV, talk about on this episode is how monarchy, militarism, and capitalism move quietly together, how royal diplomacy can often act as corporate lobbying, how innovation and jobs become cover for arms deals, and how cities like Montreal are being reshaped into military and weapons tech hubs without public consent. This conversation is about fighter jets, NATO expansion, AI research, and corruption. But it's also about something deeper, how Canada continues to imagine itself as benevolent, progressive, and peace-loving while actively participating in global systems of violence. I joined Colin at CUTV's flagship video show and podcast, Local 514, for this discussion where we pull on a thread that leads somewhere a lot darker than a three-day royal visit ever should. So if you've ever wondered what's actually happening behind the scenes of diplomacy or how public money quietly becomes war infrastructure, this episode's for you. Let's get into it.
Welcome back to Local 514. I'm your host, Colin Detsenpa. Today I'm joined by Nashwa Lina Khan.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. Nashwa, tell me a bit about the work you've done.
So I'm a researcher, a community organizer, and facilitator. And right now I mostly research at federal nonprofits around disability justice and Indigenous issues. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the hat I'm wearing these days.
It is. But today I have you wearing sort of the anti-royalty crown. How'd you describe it?
You know, it's a natural progression because I have a anti-monarchy podcast called Habibti, Please.
Is it officially anti-monarchy?
I'm stamping it that way today.
Boom. Look at that. Exclusive. Exclusive announcement here on Local 514.
Yes, Habibti, Please is coming out as anti-monarchy. And yeah, so today we're wearing that hat because for some reason we had some people visiting our lovely city.
Some people. We had, as the title of the episode should inform you, we had these Swedish royals visiting Montreal, Ottawa, and Canada in general for a little three-day visit. I was like, okay, yeah. When I'm trying to do my usual scan, my raking through the news, I'm trying to see what can we talk about on Local 514? What does the Local 514 audience need to know about? And I saw this thing about Swedish royals and I was like, man, maybe this could be a quick thing. It was not a quick thing. Because the more we looked into it, the weirder it was. And the more surprised I was that people were not talking about this visit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess not just because it's just a cute little visit, but because there's like, I think, much broader implications about Canada's military industrial complex, Sweden's own kind of like positioning as a humanitarian arms exporter, which is like, I think you said yourself, kind of an oxymoron.
Huge oxymoron.
Yeah.
Huge contradiction.
We just can't, it's like one of those like rabbit holes I kept digging into. And I was surprised at every corner. Nashua and I took our time and did some digging and found out a lot of stuff that we're going to share today. I guess just off the bat, what did you think about just when you first saw the headline? What was your reaction? Swedish royal family visiting Canada for 3 days.
So I was confused. And I was confused because what do we naturally affiliate Sweden with? Why would they be coming to Canada? What would IKEA. They bring? Yes, IKEA.
Maybe they're coming to open up a new IKEA store.
Nice linens, outdoor spas, cinnamon buns.
Horror movies.
Yes, and we expect maybe Princess Nokia in Montreal to come through on a tour, but no, we get Princess IKEA.
Oh.
Princess IKEA. And she's here to assemble weapons and partnerships in 12 easy steps and an Allen key.
That's right. Make sure you start assembling it on the carpet.
Yeah, and so I was puzzled. I think you were puzzled. I think others, and I think it didn't get its due diligence in mainstream media. If anything, CBC, Global News, City News.
Yeah.
The National was just very crazy about it, very normizing.
They were
of
just
it.
Kind of like, oh, isn't it cute that they're here? You know?
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like very matter of factly where I felt no one was even digging deeper. Because even it's like, I mean, it's just poor journalism because it's like, I just did like maybe 5 minutes of research, like 5 minutes into, sorry, I did more than 5 minutes of research.
I was going to say, please don't say that.
5 minutes into my research, I'm uncovering stuff about how this the Swedish arms manufacturer that we'll talk about has like corruption cases like that go from like the UK, South Africa, the Czech Republic, the United Arab Emirates, like everywhere that this Swedish arms manufacturer has been has sort of, there's been corruption investigations that have followed. And to me, I'm like, I'm looking in the direction of these journalists in Montreal and Canada. I'm like, guys, this is like, this is an easy question to pose to like Melanie Joly and all the all the federal people who are trying to like bring them this company here. Is like, well, how are you going to assure that this corruption won't happen here in Canada? But you know, who knows? People just seem to be, I don't know, just taking it, just not really criticizing it at all.
Well, I want to bring up that this is like not a neutral ceremonial visit.
Yes.
And since the Carney government has come into power, we've had a few weird visits that are shaping Canada to fit back. And I would say align back into a kind of historical archaic system of being okay with monarchy and imperialism in a new way. That's very, very like trying to mask, but it's so mask off. Like, why was King Charles here for the ceremony?
People were treating that as if it was such a
big... Yes, I was in Ottawa. I saw it. I was there.
People were like, oh yeah, we got Trump by inviting the king.
Yeah.
It's like, what? So we have to get like the other, like this other figure who has not Canadian and we pretend and, like this is some big like...
And it was so scary to see people dressed up for it in the hats and like the, like it was actually really scary because I didn't think we had that energy here, but I want to like say with the Swedes, not a neutral visit, a ceremonial monarchy visit. Nope. They weren't just here to like see maple syrup and like, you know, do the things that Harry and Meghan did. They were here on a very specific mission that I want you to talk to me about.
Yes.
About this diplomacy that they want to establish with military diplomacy. Like, what is this genre of diplomacy that we're seeing that's not just visiting to say hi?
They are here as sort of corporate lobbyists for a Swedish arms manufacturer. So that's the thing that really surprised me when I was looking at these, the first instances of me like kind of scraping around for news articles where I was like, oh, a Swedish royal family visiting. I was like, this is like so like C-tier news. I was like, who cares? but then I would see like they came here specifically to talk about fighter jets. They're trying to get pitch Canada on buying some fighter jets. And this has been something like, to give a little more context, like, because of all the trade sort of like war, maybe not trade war, but like kind of like the stuff with the tariffs, right? And Trump, Carney told his team, all right, guys, like, let's reconsider, let's review this supposed 88, the purchase of 88 F-35 fighter jets from American company Lockheed Martin. And after that review, Sweden is here like, hey, baby. Consider us. Remember us. You guys like IKEA? Yeah, we got jets too. And so these two Swedish royals were here trying to, I guess, just pitch the government on why we should buy the Saab Gripen jet.
And for those who don't know, can you tell us what a Saab Gripen is?
I would love to.
Because I think people are more familiar with the F-35 given campaigns that have been happening around. But what's a Gripen? And why should we be worried that they're going to start hitting Canada in 3 to 5 years is the estimate from CBC, actually.
Yeah. So they're saying, Saab is saying that Canada could get... Well, I mean, the interesting thing about this, it's not just the purchase of these Gripen jets. Because there's this kind of older class of Canadian fighter jets that are kind of like reaching age and they need to be sort of decommissioned. I'm really, that's, for me personally, I think for most of our audience, not really quite a huge concern.
It's not a P1.
No.
P1 and Q4.
Ain't a P1. Guess what? That is, put that at the bottom of the pitch.
Triage bed. That. Like our hospital weight room.
Like our hospital weight room. Remind them. So the Saab... JASS 39 Gripen fighter jet is a sort of this kind of new generation of fighter jets that was produced by Swedish designers. Currently, they are being made both in Sweden and also in Brazil. They kind of opened up some production there. And currently they are in talks of not just selling them to Canada, but also developing some of the jets here.
Yeah.
That's something the Swedes are saying, or they're saying, okay, listen, if you buy the jets, guess what? Just because we like you, you're going to be able to, we're going to bring some of the production here. And with that, they do that because then they can say like, oh, we're creating jobs, you know, like
yeah.
when they expanded, like the production in Brazil, it was the same claim, you know, we're going to bring this kind of like very high tech, first world country kind of production to you, increase it, and you get to benefit from that economically. So it's like you're buying it, but you're kind of putting the money back into your own economy is the pitch. There's a lot of YouTube videos online about the Saab Gripen. There's a lot of like you'll have those kinds of like, you know, like the history nerds. I've kind of discovered this little subsection of like